Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are very pleased to be here today to have our off-site court in Marion County. It's always a special treat for us as a court, and we hope that you feel that way as well. We will begin. First of all, I would like to welcome the high school students that are with us today. I believe we have Pleasant High School and Marion Harding High School with us today. I want to thank the students, thank their teachers, and the lawyers who have mentored this high school group and helped them with the preparation for the cases that we will be hearing this morning. We'll start off with our first case, which is 11-899, Tracy Ruther, individually an administrator of the estate of Timothy Ruther and versus George Kaiser et al. For the appellants, we'll start with Michael Hendershot.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the state here is amicus. We'll divide time with appellant. Ms. Klaus will take the last 5 minutes. I'll endeavor to take the first 10. Your Honors, the state is here in defense of the constitutionality of Revised Code 2305-113C, the medical malpractice statute of repose. But before addressing that question, I want to raise a preliminary matter with the court. As amicus, I want to be cautious about the record, but we think there is a legitimate question here as to whether the statute applies between these parties. That is, because as we read the record, there is no alleged act or omission of medical negligence after 1998 in the complaint, and the statute on its face in Section 6A of the uncodified language applies only to acts or omissions that postdate the April 11th, 2003 effective date of the act. So if we're right about the record, we think the best course here is to vacate the two decisions below and to remand to the trial court for proceedings consistent with that judgment, because both of the decisions below, we would say, applied a statute that did not apply between the parties and therefore inappropriately reached and resolved a constitutional question. But again, as amicus, I don't want to be presumptuous about the record. So if we're wrong about that, and if the court does reach the constitutional question, we think it should be by asking whether Hardy versus Vermeulen should remain the law of Ohio. There, we don't hesitate. We say the answer is an emphatic no. That is because Hardy versus Vermeulen cannot survive a Gallatus analysis. That is, it was wrongly decided at the time. It defies practical workability and has not engendered significant reliance interests. To start with the first of those factors, the history, we'd say that Hardy versus Vermeulen was wrongly decided at the time because it is inconsistent with the long history of Article I, Section 16. That history has a long lineage. Indeed, it stretches back to the Magna Carta itself, nearly 800 years ago. There, the language that ultimately comes to us in Article I, Section 16, was a promise extracted from the king to end the abusive practice of selling writs in the royal courts. The important question, though, is how would that language have been understood by those in Chillicothe in 1802 who gathered to put together Ohio's foundational document?
So this is an originalist argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The first factor under the Gallatus analysis to ask, was Hardy correctly decided at the time, is to ask what was the original meaning of that provision when it was inserted into Ohio's Constitution.
And the provision says verbatim what?
It says that for an injury done to a person, they shall have a right to a remedy by the due course of the law.
And how hard is that to understand?
Well, I think that its history over time shows that from its origin in 1215 in the Magna Carta, through the writings of Coke and Blackstone, through the 1802.
Well, we're in 2012. The right to remedy has been regarded as sacrosanct. Now, in Arbino, this court approved some outer limits on the amount of damages that could be recovered, but this court has really never said you can extinguish a right to a remedy. And in this case, as I understand it, the problem is the plaintiff could not possibly have been aware or wasn't aware of the the claim, the potential injury, until after the statute of repose, the time under the statute of repose ran. So therefore, the remedy is extinguished.
Well, a couple of points, Your Honor. It is an originalist argument, and I think in the spirit of your dissent in Garrett versus Sandusky, the question that we bring before the court is, what was the intention of those who put this language into the Constitution in 1802? Well,
Garrett is a sovereign immunity case.
Right, Your Honor. There I understand you were dealing with the part that was added to Article I, Section 16 and 1912. I think the argument we bring before you here is, just like in Garrett, to ask, as this court has said several times, the pole star of interpreting the Constitution is to ask what was in the minds, what was the intent of those who put that language into the Constitution originally, whether it was as part of the first Constitution or as an amendment. And here, remedy by the due course of law is one concept. From the Magna Carta forward, the idea behind that is a process concern, not a substantive concern. And that, we submit, as we've explained in the brief, is what would have been understood by those who put that language in the Constitution first in 1802.
Are you related to Bill Batchelder?
No, sir, I'm not.
Because I heard him make an argument based on the Magna Carta when I was in law school. But really, the language of our Constitution is pretty plain and straightforward. And our predecessors on this court have had no trouble understanding what it meant.
Well, a couple of things, John. I think that it isn't just the Magna Carta. It isn't just history for history's sake. If we look at what was in the minds of those in 1802, and we look at all of the other constitutional conventions, 1851, 1873, and 1912, never once has Article I, Section 16 discussed in those conventions as a restriction on legislative power. It's always been directed at judicial abuses. And again, not just history for history's sake, but the problem with Hardy is not just its inconsistency with history, there is its practical unworkability. That is, Hardy remaining part of the judicial landscape, we would submit, leads to difficulties for this court's precedent, difficulties for other courts relying on this court's precedent, ultimately difficulties for the General Assembly in terms of them knowing which of their statutes would survive constitutional review, and then ultimately those who rely on those laws, whether it's the doctors and hospitals who are amici here, the product manufacturers, the architects and engineers, those subject to professional negligence torts, all of them operate somewhat in uncharted territory with Hardy.
So if I'm not clear on how this latest iteration of the statute works, if a doctor during surgery or and those attending leave a sponge or two in your belly and sew you up and you don't discover it for 10 years, no recourse?
That is a specific exception that was right. Not in the statute when a similar statute was considered in the 1980s.
But they put it in this time.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is a statutory exception. So there's a distinction drawn in the statute between a foreign body left behind.
But that's workable, and the rest would be unworkable.
Your Honor, it's not so much the statute that we're saying is unworkable. It's Hardy as a precedent in combination with, for example, Groach, for example, Pratt v. Stewart, for example, Flagstar Bank. Those precedents together, we would submit, leaves an unworkable judicial landscape for other courts to interpret what this court's precedent mean for statutes. I think a prime example might be the statute of repose for securities violation found in Chapter 1700 of the Revised Code. As to that statute, looking at Hardy, looking at Groach, looking at the landscape of this court's precedents, one federal court, the Northern District in Ohio, looked at those and concluded that the security statute of repose is unconstitutional under the Ohio Constitution. The Sixth Circuit just 2 weeks ago, not in an appeal from that case, concluded exactly the opposite. So, again, to come back to the history question, it isn't just history for history's sake. It is history as a foundation to make the landscape of this court's precedents even, and therefore predictable, not only for other courts, but for the General Assembly, but for those who rely on those laws.
If we find your Gallatus argument to be unpersuasive, do you lose if we follow Hardy?
I don't think so, Justice O'Donnell. That's because at least three members of this court, and possibly four, depending on how you do the math, have said that there is a reduced analysis under Gelatis for constitutional questions. That is, the force of stare decisis is not as great when we're looking at a constitutional precedent as you would with a statutory or common law precedent like
Gelatis. Well, in the medical malpractice context, if I understand it correctly, it's from the termination of the relationship of the patient and the physician or a discovery period when the patient discovers or should have reasonably discovered as the commencement time for the accrual of the cause. Is that fair?
Yes, sir. Our reading of, say, Freisinger versus Leach in 1987 is that both of those rules survive in terms of the accrual period for the statute of limitations. I think that is a fair
statement. Therefore, what would be the accrual period for the statute of limitations for the patient in this case?
I think it's important to separate the accrual for the statute of limitations from what I think is fairly characterized as a statute of repose.
Should we not use the same accrual period for the commencement for the statute of limitations as we should for the statute of repose? Because that's generally the way it is. If you look at a statute of repose in the architectural realm or in the construction field or others where it applies, everyone knows when it begins, and then if you don't file your action after 10 years or 15 years, you can't file your action. But we all began from the same point. It occurs to me that in the medical context here, we have one commencement point for the running of the statute of limitations and a different commencement point for the running of the statute of repose. And that's my problem. Can you help me understand how to resolve that?
Certainly, and I think that is a function of the statute. So 2305.113.
Well, that's why the statute is being contested as being in violation of the Constitution, because it seems to deny the remedy. No one is saying you can't have a statute of repose, but it seems unfair, at least at first blush, to say before you knew you had a cause of action, the statute of repose says you can't file it.
Well, Your Honor, it's as we heard during the presentation to the students, it's not always for us in this body to judge the fairness of the acts that the General Assembly passes.
No, but it's for this court to judge the constitutionality of that. And if we have a provision, as Justice Pfeiffer points out, that you have a right to a remedy, try to answer the problem I'm having for me, or help me work my way through why we have different commencement periods and why we shouldn't all have the same one.
Sure, Your Honor. Like I said, that is a function of the statute, and I think it is also a function of, say, the statute of repose for products. That is, one clock is ticking for the statute of limitations from often a discovery of the injury. The statutes of repose often function where they tick from the moment of the wrongful act. So here, it's the act or omission of medical negligence that starts the repose period. If you look at what this court did in Groach, Your Honor, there, considering the product liability statute of repose, that clock ticked even before Mr. Groach ever came into contact with the machine that was delivered to his place of work that then injured him after the repose period had ended. And in Groach, of course, his court upheld that statute against a facial constitutional attack. I would say it's also consistent with what this court did in Pratt v. Stewart in 2010 and in Flagstar Bank in 2011, where the court approved statutes of limitations without discovery rules, which operate just like, Justice O'Donnell, your question as to a clock ticking before there's knowledge of the injury.
Mr. Hendershot, are you agreeing that the statute is not substantially different from the statute that was considered in Harvey, and that's why you're Hardy, and that's why you're arguing Hardy so strenuously against it, rather?
Yes, Justice Lanzer, I would say the statute is different, but not in a relevant respect when it comes to analyzing what this court did.
So that's why you're emphasizing Harvey so much. Is that correct, Hardy?
Well, we're emphasizing Hardy, Your Honor, because we think that it is that addressing Hardy and whether it can remain the law of Ohio does answer the question here. We think also that it is wrongly decided for the historical reasons and also as part of the judicial landscape leads to unworkability. See, I've gone over my promised time as to Ms. Klaus, so let me yield that time to her. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Karen Klaus here on behalf of Dr. Kaiser.
Can you speak up a bit, please?
Good morning. I'm Karen Klaus here on behalf of Dr. Kaiser and Warren County Family Practice. I see that I only have about 2 minutes remaining, so I will try to hit just a couple of points. As to the issue of the statute of repose, the statute of repose applies to a cause of action that is vested. And if a cause of action is vested, that cause of action cannot be brought if more than 4 years has passed. The problem is defining when a cause of action is vested. A cause of action is vested if it has accrued, meaning the patient has discovered that injury but has not brought that cause of action within 4 years after it has been discovered or the physician-patient relationship has terminated.
So do we have to overturn Hardy, Burgess, and all of the, even the language in Grouch in which it distinguished Hardy and said that this is different from the medical area. So we have to overturn all of that?
To some extent, I think we do, or I think we say that Hardy applied to that circumstance but limited in its application because Hardy, to some extent, was inconsistent in its terminology. It talked in one sense about accrual of the cause of action, and in another sense it talked about the legislature not being able to take away a vested right or a vested cause of action. And what we're saying is the statute of repose does not take away a vested cause of action.
Vested, if, but you don't know case, about it.
Well, if you don't know about it, if you haven't discovered it, it's not a vested cause of action. Because that's what the case law has said, is the cause of action does not accrue, it does not vest until the patient has discovered it.
Do you think the statute of repose has run in this case?
Yes, I do.
Well, the patient didn't know of the cause of action till after it ran. Isn't that a given fact to hear?
He didn't discover it, so he didn't have a cause of action. And once he
He didn't have a cause of action? Is that what you said?
The cause of action had not vested. It had not accrued. And frankly, what we know is he had lab results.
When did the patient learn of it in this case, in your view?
He learned that he had liver cancer in 2008.
All right.
He learned that he had some prior elevated liver enzymes after he discovered he had liver cancer. Whether those liver enzymes were an early indication of the liver cancer, we don't know, because those were 10, 12, 13 years earlier. Patients don't, as a general rule, live 10, 12 years with undiagnosed liver cancer. That's the leap that the plaintiffs are now trying to make, is he had liver cancer, was living with liver cancer that was totally undiagnosed and untreated. But that's the substantive facts of the case, which is not the issue that we're here today to talk about. What we're here today to talk about is whether the statute of repose bars his case. And, yes, we believe the statute of repose does bar his case.
What was the commencement of the running of the statute of repose in your view?
The statute of repose, when he filed his case in 2009, the statute of repose already barred his claim because it had been more
than
4 years.
When did the statute of repose commence to run in this factual scenario, in your view?
If their allegation is that Dr. Kaiser should have acted on lab results back in 1998 or earlier, then the statute of repose gave him 4 years from the time of the alleged malpractice at that time to file that complaint.
So he had until 2002.
2002, yes.
He had 4 years after the 1998 last known lab test with the elevated enzymes. And you're saying because he didn't know about it, okay, he didn't know, it didn't vest for the purposes of the statute of repose, correct?
Correct.
Okay, but you're saying that had he known about it, the statute of limitations would have been the guidepost there, and he would have had a certain amount of time from the time the knowledge, any time within the statute of repose. If he would have known about it in 98 through 2002, then the statute of limitations would have been the limiting factor here,
correct.
The guidepost.
Correct.
Okay.
So the statute of repose really protects against liability if the patient doesn't become aware of an act or omission that's allegedly malpractice.
Whether the patient does or does not become aware. The statute of repose is designed to provide a period of certainty for a physician so that after a physician or any medical provider, so that after a given period of treatment or a given period of time has passed after the treatment, they can know that they can dispose of records. They don't have to continue to maintain evidence that they know that they are free from the risk of litigation after that period of repose has passed, whether it's in the malpractice context, whether it's in the construction law context, whether it's in the product liability context, whatever context we're talking about, that's what the statute of repose is designed to do.
Did you say they can dispose of records?
Well, within the context of the law.
How long does a physician have to keep records?
Well, for example, Medicare says that after 5 years after treatment, physicians can dispose of records.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Holshue?
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is John Holshue. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellee, Tracy Ruther, administratrix of the estate of Timothy Ruther. Justice Pfeiffer, you really hit it on the head when you raised the question. The way the statute.
I had more than one question, so.
Which one was that?
Yeah. First one. First question that you asked is that the statute, as it is enacted, 2305.113, takes away and extinguishes a vested cause of action, which is in direct violation of Article 1, Section 16 of the Ohio Constitution. That's exactly what this court held in the Hardy versus Vermeulen case.
Well, the argument would be that the action hasn't vested, if I understood what Ms. Klaus was arguing to us.
Exactly, Your Honor, and I totally agree, and that is exactly the key. This court has to look when the cause of action vested. And the distinction that this court, with the opinion that the Chief Justice wrote in the Grouch case, this court must look at the difference between a statute of repose and a statute of limitations. A statute of repose bars a cause of action before it ever accrues. That's what this court held in the Grouch case. A statute of limitation bars a claim after so many years after the cause of action occurs. In this case, there's no cause of action until you have an injury. You've got a duty, the failure to report the lab test, breach of that duty, and the damages that occurred arguably back 1995, 96, 97, 98. That's when the cause of action vested. And therefore, this truly, using this court's language, we're not dealing with a statute of repose because the cause of action had already occurred and was vested back in the 1990s. And therefore, we're dealing with a statute of limitations issue in this case, not a statute of repose.
Mr. Holshue,
so you're saying that if that the elevated enzymes from 1998 somehow vests the claim for liver cancer 10 years later, and that's part of what I'm struggling with between the vested claim here, because there's no causal link that I can see from the record that we have before us, which I admittedly is not complete.
Sure, Your Honor, and we did, of course, submit an affidavit of merit establishing that there was a deviation causation linked with the liver cancer. So that issue has not been addressed. This court has held, as it did, and Your Honor, the Hardy versus Vermeulen case is very similar. It was a dermatology case, I believe, where a sample was taken and it was never reported to the patient until after the 4 years. And in that case, this court held that the injury vested and the cause of action vested at the time of the taking of the sample and not reporting it to the patient so the patient could act upon it. That is to be distinguished from the Grouch case and the Cedar versus Knowlton case. The whole book of cases dealing with construction and product liability cases where there is a defect or malproduced machine, but the patient or the plaintiff is not injured until years later. And that's exactly what Chief Justice wrote.
So basically, on the Grouch situation, if I'm purchasing that machine, mm-hmm. I know that 10-year period of repose had passed. And if I'm injured or my worker's injured, That's my own risk, or my insurance company bears that risk, not the manufacturer. And that's out there on the table for people who engage in the interaction with that particular type of machine or that manufacturer,
right,
which is a distinction from a physician-patient relationship where the patient is injured, but the patient has no knowledge. So on one hand, Grouch relies on knowledge within the industry, knowledge within the practice of the parties with one another. In these medical cases, there's a one-sided pathway for that knowledge, and that's to the physician and not to the patient as well.
Chief Justice, I don't disagree with that reasoning, but I think this court, in your opinion, in Grouch, focused more on when the injury occurs. And as the majority opinion in Grouch held, it specifically distinguished the medical malpractice actions from product liability and from construction cases. This court specifically held on page 153 of its opinion in the Grouch case, specifically citing Hardy, those cases, i.e. medical negligence cases, medical malpractice cases, are distinguishable because the medical malpractice statute of repose interpreted them in them took away an existing actionable negligence claim before the injured person discovered the injury. And then, as this court put, paren, when the injury had already occurred, close paren. So I submit that is the distinguishing factor, is when the injury occurred. The court
what I heard the appellant say is that until the patient knows they've been injured, there is no vesting.
I totally disagree with that.
You don't? They didn't say that?
They may have said that, but I totally disagree. The cause of action vests when the injury occurs.
Well, that's what I wanted to question you about, because it seems that has to be the basis for this repose to be successful, is that the knowledge triggers the vesting. And if it's not vested because they had no knowledge, then the statute of repose doesn't divest them of a remedy.
Again, Your Honor, I think we're maybe saying the same thing, but just in perhaps different manner. I think the vesting of the cause of action occurs when the injury occurs. As this court held in Grouch, no cause of action ever vested because the injury occurred beyond the 10-year period that the law, that the legislature thought was reasonable for a product liability case. So because there is no injury and therefore no vesting beyond the 10 years, as this court held in Grouch, no cause of action ever existed.
Are you claiming that the cancer actually existed back when those first enzymes were detected and that it was undetected, the cancer itself was undetected? Is that your claim?
That is what the basis of our underlying malpractice case is, Your Honor, because what happened is there were elevated liver enzymes. We have had this case reviewed. And we did, as I mentioned to Justice McGee Brown, we have submitted an affidavit of merit with our case.
So this would be a real outlier because most people don't survive liver cancer that period of time untreated.
Your Honor, I submit
that. So you have a pretty big burden of proof, but you're actually claiming for the purpose of this case that there wasn't some failure to just diagnose elevated liver enzymes, but that the cancer itself already existed when those elevated liver enzymes were detected. That's your claim.
That's the basis of our underlying claim, Your Honor.
And therefore, the failure to look at those elevated enzymes and detect the cancer is the basis of your claim of malpractice, not just something else about that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I want to come back to where you started with both Justice O'Donnell and the Chief. You're saying the claim vested back in 10, 12 years ago.
Correct.
Right. And so the only issue for you is, did you timely file after discovery? And you did.
Correct.
So what does that leave us? Are you saying that the statute is therefore only unconstitutional as they were trying to apply it to your case? It's that we don't have to find the statute itself unconstitutional, and the defendant was trying to unconstitutionally apply it. The trial court got it right, and the Court of Appeals got it right, saying their argument in trying to apply it to bar your claim would be unconstitutional, but because neither court did that, we don't have to find anything unconstitutional happened. Is that correct?
Absolutely. 100% correct, mm-hmm. Your Honor. That's exactly what the trial court held, and all three members on the Court of Appeals held that the statute 2305.11...
It would be unconstitutional if applied in the way the defendant seeks to have the court apply it.
As applied to the facts in this case. You're absolutely correct, Your Honor.
I need to understand, counsel, with respect to the discovery rule. The discovery rule starts the statute of limitations running.
Correct.
Is your position that the discovery rule has no application whatsoever to the statute of repose? Because well, that's what I think you're saying here.
Again, Your Honor, and Justice Lansinger, in all fairness, we are dealing, the question is, are we dealing with a statute of repose in this case, or are we dealing with a statute of limitations? I submit to you, as this court has held consistently since the Cedar case, even back as far as the Hardy versus Vermeulen case, this is not a statute of repose issue because the cause of action existed and was vested back at the time in the 1990s.
And your position is that vesting does not in any way depend upon the knowledge of the patient, the discovery of the injury.
For purposes of the statute of limitations, it absolutely does apply.
But I'm saying for the statute of repose, because the vesting part is where, to me, I guess Justice O'Donnell made the point, why not use the same standard for both statutes? And that's where the discovery rule is kind of a hurdle for me here.
Sure. In all fairness, Justice, I think the distinction has been created by this court between the statute of repose and the statute of limitations. As the Chief Justice wrote in the Grouch opinion, there is a critical distinction, again, quoting from the Chief in the opinion on page 142, that unlike a true, the Chief stated, there's a critical distinction between statutes of repose and statutes of limitations. Unlike a true statute of limitations, which limits the time in which the plaintiff may bring suit after the cause of action accrues, a statute of repose potentially bars a plaintiff's suit before the cause of action arises. Again, the example being construction, product liability, where somebody is not injured until after the statute of repose period. In this case, where Timothy Ruther was injured by failure to advise him of those lab results back 12 years ago before suit was filed, that's when the cause of action accrued. And under the Oliver case, and every case since then, in the last 25 years, this court has consistently held that for limitations purposes, it isn't until the patient discovers the injury or has reason to discover the injury. So purposes of the statute of limitations, which I submit is the issue in this case, not a repose issue, but a statute of limitations issue, it is from the time of discovery, which this court has consistently held. Justice Lansinger, another interesting issue, while we're on that point, is that in the same statute, 2305.11.3, as pointed out, I believe, by Justice Pfeiffer or Justice O'Donnell, there is a specific provision dealing with a foreign object left within the body. And the legislature did not put any time limit whatsoever on that restriction. So if a doctor leaves several sponges, a forceps, a hemostat inside a patient, 50 years later, suit can be brought under the statute. If the doctor has lab results and fails to advise the patient of that, under the statute, 4 years, whether you discover it or not.
Isn't that the point? If they wanted it to be 50 years, they could have said, in addition to the foreign bodies and so on, that we are saying, omission of lab results will also be an exception to the repose statute.
Sorry, Your Honor. That's exactly what this court held in Hardy. As this court held in Hardy, the statute as it was written, and I think with Justice McGee Brown, there has been really as acknowledged by the state, virtually no difference in the statute we're dealing with here and the statute we were dealing with in the Hardy case. And as this court held in the Hardy case, that statute is a direct violation of of Article 1, Section 16 of the Bill of Rights and failing to give due process, due access to the courts, and a right to a remedy under the open courts provision. That's what we're dealing with in this case, and it's for that reason we believe strongly that this statute is unconstitutional.
Can you envision any scenario in which, in a medical malpractice scenario, where a statute of repose works?
Justice Stratton, I was waiting for that question.
You were hoping someone would ask that.
I honestly haven't. I sat in my office for the last 2 weeks trying to think of that scenario. And the best I can come up with, and it's not a very good one, is if a patient goes in for a mammogram and there is a mass or some abnormality on the mammogram, but the patient is never told about it. And yet 5 years later, the patient is diagnosed with breast cancer. The situation, but let's say the difference, it turns out that the breast cancer that was found 5 years later was not the same mass that was on the mammogram. Okay? In that situation, I submit that the cause of action would not apply to this case because you had a negligent act back at the time of the mammogram, failing to advise of the results of the mammogram, but theoretically the injury didn't occur until 5 years later. You know, there's a whole proximate cause issue, of course, related with that. Mm-hmm. But that's the only scenario, in all fairness to the court, that I could even
Well, counsel, let me give you one that's been on my mind almost from my start on this court, and that is the DES cases. How would this play out? I mean, those cases have their own set of problems in the difficulty of proof of who manufactured the drug. It was all bad.
Right.
It all caused profound injuries a generation later. How would this play out?
Well, I think exactly the same way. This court held that those cases, the statute of repose, was totally unconstitutional in the DES cases for that very reason. And in fact, this court, as I read that case, even went farther and basically said all statutes of repose where the injury occurs before the time, yet before discovery, should be held unconstitutional. I don't think this court's gone that far, but I totally agree with you, Justice, that under the DES case, where the injury occurred at the time but wasn't discovered until many years later, that violated Article 1, Section 16, exactly as the statute in this case does.
Okay. But for you to prevail, we really don't have to do anything about the constitutionality of this statute on its face.
As you want to. But you're correct.
I sort of doubt that.
He may want to.
I know I'm out of time, but if I can just briefly answer, as the trial court and the Court of Appeals held, as applied is how this case came down. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Hendershot, who's going to? Okay, you have 30 seconds for rebuttal.
And I'm going to ask you a question so you can think about it as you go up. We've used
Thank
the
you.
Term cause of action existed at the time the malpractice was committed, and then we've used the term, but it doesn't accrue until later. But then I think we've used accrue, it accrues at the time that it occurs. So can you help straighten out this difference between when a cause of action existed and when it accrues?
And I think part of the problem is whether we're talking about the cause of action or whether we're talking about the injury. And if I can maybe use a different circumstance to try to help explain that. The injury in this case, at least as the plaintiff wants to posit it, is Mr. Ruther had the injury when he had the abnormal liver enzymes. And the distinction still needs to be sorted out when we get to the substantive facts of the case at some point, whether he actually had liver cancer then or whether he had just elevated liver enzymes that required some follow-up evaluation. The cause of action accrues when there's discovery that there's an actual injury. I don't know if that helps or not. Let me put it in another circumstance to see if that helps more. One of the cases we cited in our brief was the McClure versus Alexander, which is actually a construction case, and maybe that makes it a little easier to understand. In McClure, there was work done on a home, an addition built on a home, I think in 1988 or 1989. In 1994, 15 years later, the homeowner discovered that there had been water damage occurring in this addition over a period of time. There was a 10-year statute of repose. So, but the argument was, well, we didn't discover there was this water damage that had been occurring until 15 years later. What the court held, consistent with the Groch opinion of this court, was you're too late to file that claim. The injury, the damage, had been occurring over a period of time, back over a number of years earlier, but it wasn't discovered until too late to file the claim. The injury had occurred back in 89 and 90 and 92 over a period of years, but it wasn't discovered until 2004 when the claim was brought.
So under your theory then, does if I have not disclosed lab results, is it best then to just wait until that four-year period has elapsed and escape all liability?
Well, no, I don't. First of all, I don't think you'd escape all liability because there are other cause of actions that can be brought. And frankly, I don't think doctors are going to hope in most of them.
I'm just posing a hypothetical. Yes,
in that sort of
right. I agree, but I'm
nefarious manner. But and there are other cause of actions for fraud and concealment.
But let's take your hypothetical, please.
I don't think you escape liability in that fashion.
Mm-hmm. But given what you've just said, if you have lab results, if we use the fact situation you just posited, if you have lab results and for whatever reason they're not disclosed to the patient until 6 years later, under your theory, there's no liability. The statute of repose kicks in to protect the physician.
There may not be malpractice liability for the statute of repose, but there's other causes.
That's what we're talking about is the statute of repose. Yes. I just want to understand your argument. That's it.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
But yes, if it's been concealed, there are other causes of action that can still be brought.
Thank you.
Are you using the term cause of action accruing to be the same as a cause of action vesting?
Yeah, I don't think there's vesting until the cause of action has accrued.
It vests when it accrues?
Yes.
In your view?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision.